This is Tsukui Gar, a Star Wars Legends, Star Wars The Clone Wars, Star Wars Republic Commando series, Rebellion Era fanfic, written by Countess of Biscuit and read by Rena Jenkins. The story is rated R and contains the pairing Boba Fett, Bo-Katan Kryze, with additional tags for Return of the Jedi, Rebels Compliant, Mandalore, Mandalorian Fets, Alliance Politics, Bounty Hunters, Survival, Past Hurt, Present Comfort, Bickering, Hope, Yielding at the Edges, Coming Home, Honorable Mention, Fen Shisa, and was recorded for me, Rena Jenkins, as part of Star Wars Rare Pair Exchange 2019. Summary. It would be a salvage of magnificent proportions, said the barkeep, if you didn't mind the reek of broiled hut. The bounty hunter did mind. But she waited all the same, nursing what passed for Tahar on Tatooine, for the first scavengers to return from across the Dune Sea. Sandcrawlers were always worth a rifle, and she had nowhere in particular to be. The Jawas wouldn't discuss the terrain sensors or warped hull plates. But would she trade for these charred reliefs in the Huttese style? Or this set of humanoid armor, with the Sarlacc's half-digested meal still warm inside? She tried not to laugh as she parted with her bandolier and diamond stud. Bounty hunting was a capricious profession. The bounty was old, and the head that claimed it was older still. It was also inconclusive, ever since a SEP scientist in Kaldabe had generated a very targeted anti-aging treatment, and a rogue Republic loyalist on Kamino had decommissioned himself in a flurry of leaked remote access codes. A bioscan would be equally useless, except to stress that this Fett was close to death. So the Mandalore pocketed the puck that said this might cost her considerable credits, and called for the armor. The bounty hunter had no choice but to produce it. Half alive, half price, said the Mandalore, who knew her Beskar gem. The bounty hunter shrugged. There's always Shisa. He won't thank you either. You've ruined his face. Sarlacc's spit tends to do that. Spared his balls, though. He'll still stud. With a slow nod from the Mandalore, Fen Shisa's dream dynasty was stymied again, and the bounty hunter's pockets deepened materially. Not bad for an afternoon's afterthought in Mos Espa, and on a bounty that the guild considered expired. She was halfway out the chamber when a protector sidestepped into her path. You know, Beroya, came the Mandalore's silvery voice, there's an Imperial export ban on Beskar. The bounty hunter's fingers tightened around the handle of the repulsor crate. Unrefined, yes. You can argue that point with our customs authority. They make special deals for Black Sun. The protector powered up his carbine, eloquently introducing himself and his terms of negotiation. You know, Mandalore, said the bounty hunter, I gave you first refusal. It's not exactly best practice. Because you knew Shisa wouldn't be good for it. That was smart. Trying to sell that armor onto some fucking core wielder won't be. Every hand in the room twitched for their blasters. That wasn't forced sensitivity. It was pure professional intuition. So the bounty hunter tried to appeal to what pacts there were between insurgents and opportunists. Sabine said things had changed. She didn't say you'd become just as much of a bully as the Empire. We adapt, we survive. Now get out of here, Onyo, before I radically renegotiate our deal. The bounty hunter left, and the Beskar gem stayed. Its green and yellow paint was flaked and chipped in places, and it stank like Stroll's bile, but it was otherwise unspoilt. It had fared much better than its owner, who was hurried away to the medbay before he became one very expensive corpse. They had only one tank in the mines underneath the old governor's compound, and the Mandalore worried a footpath around it, studying the burned body of the man she'd bought in the unnatural light. Many joined her in her revolutions, a silent cavalcade of the curious and the incredulous, and the inimical, too. It was the way of the Mandalore to bury the blade, but others still held them warm in their palms. So she kept vigil over an uncertain enemy, wondering what to do with him. "You followed his father," said the Mandalore, to one whose loyalty counted for more than most.
"And now I follow you," Fen Rao replied.
"And if he took up the saber?" The corners of his mouth twitched.
"If he could get it from you."
"If I gave it to him." They halted as one, and Rao's blue-eyed wonderment finally fell away from the tank.
"You'd spend such credits only to humor Kildabe anyway?"
"I spent those credits to give Fett a choice, and to give us a chance at keeping a hard-won truce." Mandalorians were egalitarian.
They were also dangerously romantic. Bored of breaking against the Empire to no avail, they might come up with any reason to break against each other again, along the same old fault lines. She could stem some violence if an upstart Fett decided to reach for Tar's legacy. She could do nothing if Shisa and the Northern clans had Fett by the sack and decided she could keep her relic and her glory, for true Mandalore had come home at last.
"It'd be a priceless hollow.
Nothing more,"
Rao said finally, looking at her in earnest.
"The only honor would be in handing it back. He has much more to gain than heirloom valor."
"Indeed."
"Boba Fett was Darmanda, and he wasn't out of the maw yet."
The Metroids had rotated 5 times, and the Mandalore hadn't left the compound once, when he was finally drawn out of the Bacta, wiped down, and carted to an empty room to make way for the casualties of the latest and last strike of the year on Sundori. It was another rotation more before he opened his eyes. They grew wide and vexed as he glanced around, taking in his survival and his fresh defeat in one. Under the sheets, his hands fumbled around his groin. Poor Shabika. More worried about his sack than his sight.
He'd be all right then.
"Your leg was broken and your ankle fractured," the Mandalore announced bluntly. She had never learned to deal in pleasantries, and Boba Fett wouldn't appreciate them. He also wouldn't appreciate a laundry list of injuries the Bacta had taken care of, so she didn't expound. "They've been reset, but you'll be in the plexicast for a few days. Others needed the tank more than you." He slumped deeper into the pillow, his voice hoarse and flat.
"I should have died."
"Don't be pathetic. Do you know who I am?" His eyes flicked to her face a second time, more casually, perhaps comparing all the lines with all the years.
She had bounties out too, even older than his, and more lucrative besides.
The renegade daughter of Duke Kreese would have fetched a handsome credit once upon a time.
"Yes."
"Then you know under whose protection you find yourself. That makes 3 people with a vested interest in keeping you and your Fett-blessed balls away from Kildabe. Or whoever else might want them. Cheer up."
"Why? So you can publicly remove them with that off-brand laser sword of yours?"
"Do you get that out of a holo novel? Wait."
Bo-Katan sat back, holding up a finger.
"You probably did. Because your father walked away from where I sit now and didn't teach you a shabla thing."
The tendons in his neck and forearms flexed, like he wanted to put some force behind what he said next, but was tempered by circumstance and fatigue.
"He taught me enough about Death Watch."
Bo-Katan stood, reassured that he'd last the night at least. "That movement is over. We've moved on.
Sorry we've been too busy to redecorate.
Before she could leave, he asked abruptly,
Who collected?
I think professional courtesy demands I don't say. She plucked a pistol from a holster and tossed it to him.
They aren't here anyway. You won't be disturbed, but feel free to shoot anyone foolish enough to enter.
The next morning brought the Mandalor back to Fett's bedside, armed with breakfast and renewed patience from a few hours' sleep.
Hi, Lisa Thore,
she said, depositing the bowl into his lap.
Eat up.
Fett's petulance had only worsened, embittered, no doubt, by his first sleepless night pissing through a tube. The sleeplessness was his own stubborn fault.
She'd help him with the tube if he'd unclench a little.
To that end, Bo-Katan sat down on the bed, close enough to feel the warmth of his big thigh through the sheet. Close enough to make him think twice about doing anything stupid.
You need your strength, she said. Why? So I can escape?
If you feel like it. But as my guest, you could just walk out the front door once your legs heal. You'll need to eat something first. The mattress seemed to soften with him a little.
Where am I?
You're in Concordia, in the old stronghold of House Vizsla, and you're on the third floor in the northwest wing, if you want to know.
We have no spaceports, and only one lane the Empire isn't watching. But we get no tourists or alliance quacks, and we're not nearly as interesting to the Empire as Mandalore.
They're not on planet, by the way. The honesty disarmed him, and he shrugged heavily.
Emoting like a fellow buckethead, at least. Not my problem.
Really?
Your last job with them didn't end so well.
Wasn't their job.
Whose then?
Jabba's.
And it ended fine. The mistake was hanging around for the show. He was trying to kill...
Information was expensive. And it was almost the only thing of value Boba Fett had left to his name. He clammed up. And Bo-Katan waited with a raised brow for him to grapple with the relatively poor currency of his news.
He's dead, you know, Jabba,
she bartered carefully.
So if you tell me he was trying to kill the Princess of Alderaan and failed, I might kiss you.
He was trying to kill a Jedi. It came out in a rush, disturbing the dust of her vanity but buoying her spirits. That surprised her.
Mandalore the Bitterborn, rejoicing at Mor Jatise in the galaxy.
Oh?
The Rebel Skywalker.
So you've seen him?
Yep. Is he a fake like they say?
His lightsaber is real enough. And someone died giving me that name. She remembered seeing Tano's master once. All floppy-haired, holo-romance hero. Exactly the sort to leave the byproducts of an illicit affair or two in his wake. If it wasn't all Alliance propaganda. Fett read the reflection on her face well.
He's the right age,
he added. The first war orphan had done the math on the last.
Well, the war made strange bedfellows.
It still did. And it made the galaxy very, very small. Fett poked at the bowl's contents, stiffly changing the subject.
You bored or something? Don't you have a rebellion of your own to run?
Who would you prefer? We're short on droids, and the medics are busy. But there's a small army of Mandalorians down here who all have something to say to you. Some would lift you up just to kiss your shibs. Others would like to dropkick you into the nearest shaft and toss a Ditton after. Good luck figuring out which is which. He upended the bowl to demonstrate the bizarre physics of the breakfast she'd provided.
I'll take anyone who can bring better food. What the criff is this?
Rat meal.
What?
Dry rations and water. Old Grand Army stock.
Kinda like you,
she smirked. He set it down on the bedside table in protest. She returned it to him. You'll thank me when you're not shit in the bed.
No, I won't.
He wasn't grateful. But he persevered through the porridge, his face coiling with every bite like a churlish child. A child who still said things like criff and liked being a petty contrarian. Bo-Katan stayed, talking at him more than with him. She talked of the Empire, of the Purge, of the clans scattered to the stars, of the very important distinction between Visla and Vizla that mattered to nobody but themselves, of many things he ought to have known but didn't. And he seemed to warm to her, his reticence drawing back at the corners, bit by stubborn bit. It had probably been a long time since he was alone with the Mandalorian. Peacefully, at least. Perhaps not since Jango's time. "How many Mando bounty hunters have you met?" she asked, eternally curious about the demographics of the diaspora.
"Dunno. I stick to my parsecs, they stick to theirs."
"You also keep the worst clientele. Guess that naturally thins the field."
"I only do odd jobs for syndicates, bureaucracies, and darksiders," he said,
one hairless brow raised, a wrinkle of judgment.
"I've never taken up arms with them."
"Have you ever taken up arms for anyone but yourself?" He made no reply. Instead, he folded himself back into silent self-pity as his bodily needs became apparent. He glanced furtively between the vac tube within arm's reach and the door far beyond the bed, where he correctly assumed the fresher to be. Bo-Katan stood and jerked the sheet from over his stiff legs.
"You can live with the goal of accepting help, or you can stay in this bed like a sick lap hound. I'll let you decide what your father would have chosen."
He suffered her assistance without a word. Wrapping her arms around his torso, she held him steady as he worked himself up from the bed. The thick muscles in his chest flexed beneath her hold. Her face flushed hot and deep as she anticipated the moment when her forearm would find the small pea of his nipple, and nothing could keep her pulse from racing when it did. The most inveterate clans bowed to a Mandalore who was still 14 at heart, mooning over the silliest features of man. Fett's hand stopped at the hem of his tunic when they finally reached the fresher.
"It's nothing I haven't seen before," Bo-Katan blurted out, unwilling to look up and betray herself.
She joined in his indignity by pretending to be unbalanced by his weight and gripped his shirt harder.
"Don't twist your flak straps."
She didn't look. She didn't have to. The dark shape in her peripheral answered her curiosity enough. And it was still there later, when she closed her eyes to put another night between her and the infamous man she'd bought. Fett was much more content the next morning, all broad, sleep-sound breaths against the pillow, with a placidity on his brown face that hadn't been there in the Bacta. One limp hand had fallen away from the blaster on his stomach. In his other lay the carved Veshuk paw that she'd lent him for the itch.
He would be even happier when he awoke to find his armor returned, fresh from a long bicarbonate bath.
Waiting quietly, she turned his helmet over in her hands. She'd picked it apart and restored the interior as well as she could. Slipping it on would be a gross invasion of privacy, but she thought about it. Thought about wearing his face as she passed the time with a hand down her flight suit. It had been some time,
and he was pitching one healthy tent.
A flurry of motion under his eyelids, and Fett was with the waking again. He jerked forward, reaching for the bucket over the blaster, and stuffed it on hastily. She smiled inwardly as he was reunited with a part of himself, in a scene of minute head tilts and faint whirring noises as the rangefinder bobbled up and down. She could almost hear the click of his teeth as he switched displays.
"Thank you,"
he said finally, pushing around the silence in the room. Bo-Katan nodded. He had been forced into lidless intimacy. Who knew what it would take to earn another face-to-face? He could use some eyebrows, but the Sarlacc scars distinguished his handsome fat features.
She hoped to look upon them again.
His head went very still. He was waiting for something, and she could guess what.
All long-range transmissions are blocked, she said.
Because I'm your prisoner.
Because the Empire monitors transceiver traffic, and I don't want all your pulls for holoporn to get flagged. Easily baited, his visor rounded slowly to face her, and she needled him some more. You want easy nookie here? You stretch your interpersonal side like the rest of us. She left him with that thought, and began pulling his plates from the crate, one by one, to array them against the wall. All the old bells and whistles had been recalibrated, and she told him so in a foreign tongue, frustrating and motivating him in equal measure. He would have to retrieve the parts and test them himself.
Drawing out a chest plate, she pointed idly at the sheaf sigil.
I understand the Fett farm is under clone management these days.
Bully for them,
he replied, taking it square on his born bent out of shape nose rather more than she intended.
Do you even know what this means? She demanded of the true Mandalorian idiot.
It was my dad's.
A simple, artless answer.
There could be no arguing with it.
If he honored his father, he honored the journeyman's ways, and their legacy lived on as best it could in these changed times. What he remembered, he rendered eternal. Bo-Katan considered herself schooled, and moved on to another lesson. It was sunny season in Sundari. The starlight was oppressive, and making a run on the biome now would be wasteful. Their shields just burned out and burned up fuel, and the citizens were always more interested in helping the limping garrison repair the damage than knocking the infrastructure right out from under their imperial boots. Disaffection was like a plague among the vulnerable. They had learned better than to stoke it. So they waited. And the Mandalore talked and walked, with the son of one whose patience was infamous. Born of one Baslan Shevla and nursed through another. A true Mandalorian life cycle, if a little singular at the start. Fett regained his strength using a second-hand Republic hoverhold, moving like a waiter burdened by a banqueting tureen as they ventured further into the compound each day. Halls and corridors fell silent upon their approach, and not just because he liked walking around in half-gam. Flight suit arms tied around his waist, sleeveless undershirt exposed, but helmeted like a Corwold advertisement for lazy Mando fancy dress. She went everywhere with him at first, wearing the saber conspicuously on her belt, within his easy reach. And if any old Kirtzade still had grit up their plates about Jango that they hadn't tried to take out on one of his billion offshoots, she'd have their heads. The blade stopped here, with her. Within a fortnight, his casts were off, and he took his first cautious steps into the crisp Concordian air. He searched the sky on instinct, charting the system on his display, getting his bearings. Bo-Katan, who wore no helmet here among her people, followed his gaze and wondered which stars he steered his heart to.
Kara,
he said, unstilling the quiet.
You've been picking stuff up.
She was glad for it, and had been relieved to see him taken in by others in the Enclave. The Goran especially esteemed him highly. Somehow, Fett had gotten word of Bo-Katan's accident trying to restore the touchy Zirka bolt-on one of his gauntlets. The accident that had sent much of the Goran's hair up in flames. And he'd spent an entire day silently sweeping the forge of metal shavings and soldering together basic underplates from a crate of spare wires. Whom the Goran favored, none could touch. Bo-Katan worried less about whom he might bump into on his daily walks. Fett shook his head.
My dad used to say that every time we punched through Kamino's cloud cover. Said the stars were fallen heroes. He never said whose. Mandalore's, I guess.
Kara is a Mandalorian concept, yes. A very ancient one, she said, as she stepped up beside him. But we couldn't boast enough fallen kings to fill even a corner of the night sky. Much less good ones. He was probably right to leave it vague.
Mandalore hovered above them, a pale and looming crescent.
See, there's my sister, she said, pointing to it. More star-like the further you get, to tell the truth.
She drew her finger across the sky to a bright, faraway dot, sinking low in the thick horizon.
Kalevala. And my other sister, always gone too soon. The next Mandalore is up there somewhere, too, kicking around from star to star with the Rebellion. I think about all of them and many more when I look up there.
I'd say there's room for your father, too. She supposed she'd just gotten spiritual with him, and maybe a little sentimental, too. But it was funny how quickly the swell of his shoulder close to her chin brought her back dirtside. Like the whole galaxy was forgettable, just a joke, and the only thing that really mattered was Fett's brown skin and how warm it might be under her touch.
His helmet ducked down at her, like he'd noticed her staring.
You've picked a rebel as your heir? Seems chancy.
Bo-Katan shrugged, ready to have this talk if he was. Some people think I should pick a bounty hunter.
Fett didn't make any reply. He just turned toward the compound, motioning for her to lead the way back inside, where supper waited in the mess. But he cornered her in the door later, when she turned to leave him for the night. He stopped her with a brief hand on her waist and arrested the momentum of her life altogether when he removed his helmet.
I don't want it, by the way, he said abruptly. She felt foolish at the rise and fall of her own expectation.
What?
Your sword.
That was good, for she had set her heart on handing it over peacefully to Ren, to show it something it had never seen before, even in the long age of Vizsla. But it wasn't what her heart craved most in that moment.
What do you want? She asked.
It was all hushed hope between them now, and though Fett wouldn't admit to a lack of anything, his eyes flicked to the window. Then they flicked back to where his hand had touched her, lingering overlong but distantly, before they then turned to the piles of circuitry naked on his bed. Bo-Katan wouldn't hover beneath him in the doorway like this, holding a paramour's desperate breath. She would return to her room, return to her senses under a cold shower, and prepare to call in the favor of a lifetime. Maybe two. Concordia, strip-mined and regularly strafed, had a lot of problems. Not as many as Concord Dawn, that backwater breadbasket of the system, but enough. And Concord Dawn at least had their proud protector tradition. Concordia had a diminished population after most of the ruling house fucked off Corwald during the Shadow Occupation, taking with them their investors, their heavy machinery, and their pure-blood strill packs. Among the problems was a serious ecological mess in the southwestern quadrant, under the management of one of Fett's brood. One of the souped-up first editions.
Aiden, you old ack,
Bo-Katan greeted the autumnal face under a Corellian spacer's cap. A strill pup was gnawing at his thick fingers.
Chief, long time no call. I like it that way, you know.
I do. I'll keep this brief. There's a ship that needs tracking down. A Firespray 31
class patrol craft that belonged to a little shit who drowned in sand. You're too late. My brothers are already on it. Bo-Katan's face grew pinched and hot. She's to put a bounty on that, too?
No, it's just a Swiss ship, and Ordo's gotten all sentimental in his protracted middle age. She could work with that.
Ordo was a noble soul, de facto Alorad around Keldabe, and always willing to break bread,
especially if it was sweet.
Sentimental enough that he'd give it back to the little shit? She asked. Aiden's hand went still between the rows of teeth.
What's that supposed to mean?
Bring me the ship first, and remember to calm ahead. No ship, no clearance, no funny business. I've got some trigger-happy gunners here who haven't had an AA light show in weeks.
Don't tempt us, Chief. A week later, no more.
Bo-Katan stood before a squad of clones. Aiden and his brother Mareel, and two of the myriad adopted grunts.
One sported a motley of commando plates and soft Imperial dugs, like a grungy, provocative scavenger. The other had gone full native with a set of red and gray Beskar gown that he wore shockingly well beneath a stylized high and tight.
Between the Republic-issued Durasteel hands of one and the rattled bucket badge on the other, she figured turnabout was fair play. And very, very Mando Karla.
You're the closest thing to elite he's got, but he's not to be bundled away to your little retirement compound, she declared.
They nodded impatiently. Butcher stepped under their arms.
And don't scare him. They scared him, exuberant strill and all, bum-rushing the room and waking their lost Vodica like they wanted a shot to the head.
Almost didn't recognize you without your head down the fresher,
Mareel said, with a playful punch to Boba's shoulder.
I would, and we've never even met, said the clone named Kor. You got Asshole Alpha Complex written all over your baby mug.
Boba remained entrenched in the bed. And not just because he was pinned by two-thirds of a strill. There had been no time to reach for his bucket. Though his face was gummed up in places by scar tissue, she was struck by his relative youthfulness. These clones had all gotten a healthy hit of whatever it was that halted their accelerated aging, but nothing could change the fact that they'd been playing hide-and-seek with droid snipers before Boba was out of diapers. Still, they were all younger than she was, nothing new. But Boba made her feel it for the first time in a while.
Well, look at this fine Fett family reunion. All makes and models, said Fi, the winsome commando. She so would be gutted he missed it. Someone should take a holo.
You can tell Shisa we missed his tail-end bombers in the last run, griped Bo-Katan.
I do notice these things.
Why do you think he's left the Chosen One here unbothered and sent his most charming ambassadors?
Replied Mareel. He relieved Boba of his untouched tisane and gave it to the Strill.
He keeps the Alliance buttered, since you never let Rao and his fancy flyboys off the leash anymore.
The princess will have Shisa on a leash when this is all over, if he's not careful, Bo-Katan said.
Oh, no need to excite him, boss, chirped Fi. Let him angle for it. Then he'd be too busy fathering sprogs with his royal missus to think about polishing up Boba here for the job,
Mareel said, scrubbing his little brother's head, for the curls had not yet returned. Boba absorbed the attention with all the cheer of a half-drowned Tuga, his mood growing darker with the rising day. They tried to engage him as best they could, when he refused to speak more than one word every 5 minutes.
Finally, they released him so he could go to the fresher.
And if Bo-Katan hadn't known what was waiting for him in the hangar, the black look he dropped on her as he stalked past her chair might have curdled her blood.
Hey, Vod,
Kor demanded an hour later, clanking his fist against the fresher door.
You done? I'd like to go myself sometime this century.
Find another one,
Boba said. Mareel pushed Kor out of the way.
Why don't you come out and take a walk with us? We got something to show you.
No.
Extracting you from this fresher won't be Spec Ops' finest hour, but we'll do it.
Okay,
came the voice of juvenile disinterest.
They'd actually started signaling among themselves to stack up when Bo-Katan stepped up to the door, rolling her eyes. Boba, they've brought something of your father's. After a bit of shuffling on both sides, the door slid open. Boba slunk out, ignoring his brothers, but looking at her with a face full of silent entreaty. And when he followed Bo-Katan out of the room, he seemed to forget all about reaching for the hoverhold to steady his way. They walked to the processional chorus of clones greeting and joshing other clones that they encountered in the compound's corridors. Boba tried to maintain the uncurious and sour facade. Bo-Katan was almost grinning to herself to see it melt as the destination dawned on him. He even picked up the pace. Slave One lay squat in the corner like a dead beetle. But Boba ran his hands along it like the ship was made of Perlemian marble. Home had come to him. Bo-Katan and the others held back, watching the reunion from afar, until the clones' army appetites got the better of them. She waved Boba over. It spoke to his equanimity that he actually complied. "Welcome to the clan, Vodica," Mareel told him simply, bumping gauntlets. "You ever want to come to Kaldabi? You'll never buy another drink. She's his orders. You might get a few smashed over your head, too, but that comes with the territory." Then his brothers swooped out as quickly as they'd swooped in, making for the compound's mess to catch up on system gossip and probably tap into the Veshok casks more than was good for them. "There was a time when no one would have gone to so much trouble just to let me go," Boba said to Bo-Katan quietly, as they watched the clones depart. "Frustrating Shisa was worth the credits," she shrugged, feeling a little funny now that her job here was done. It came out a little more bitter than sweet. "But those men have always been worth more to Mandalore than you." Bo-Katan walked away, and hoped that tinkering with his ship would stop that hard truth from ringing too much in his ears. That night, Fett decamped from the Northwest Corridor into a ship, where he lingered for weeks, pottering around doing odd jobs, waiting for stars knew what. A place in the next Sundari Strike Formation? A celebratory raiding party from Kaldabi? Some augural star alignment? She'd been generous with the fuel and supremely generous with the jump coordinates. Yet he remained, cagey with his freedom. As the nights closed in on Bo-Katan and she saw less of him, she became bothered by the other possibility. That he might wish to try his hand against her after all. He had almost perished. It would be harder to hold his battle cheap. That, or his empty pockets, presented a problem he couldn't ignore. Bo-Katan stood at her bedroom window, staring half asleep again at a starscape that held no answers, when someone knocked on her door. She opened it to find Fett, barefaced and casual, flight suit arms knotted around his firm waist. "Hi," he said, a little strangely. A little stiffly, like he was stalling for the right words to come. She spit out her dejection before it could settle in her stomach. "You're leaving?" she asked. He stepped forward. "Soon. But I'm not finished here." She scolded herself for not grabbing a vibroblade or checking him for one, instead of ogling the grip of his undershirt over his broad chest. Or the swell of his naked arms. Or the sharp cut of his thick eyebrows. Bo-Katan tensed. She froze entirely when he came even closer. Close enough that she caught a faceful of his warm breath when he began chanting in Mandoa. Bajr bal baskorgam, Aranov alit. Mandoa bal Mandalore. An venkunyan mi. Then he dropped to his knees.
Bo-Katan's blood ran fast and torrid, like someone had splashed hot tahar between her ribs. To see his face down there? To hear what she thought she heard? She almost didn't let herself believe it. Her breath wobbled. Hadn't taken you for a romantic, Fett. Never breaking her gaze, he drew his big, rough fingers up the outside of her thighs. He hooked them into the tops of her briefs, rolling them down carefully until the Mandalore was bare before him, her short curls still red as flame. Leaning forward, Fett buried his nose into them, mouth between her quaking legs, and licked slowly, deliberately up. I'm not. The end.
Reader's notes. So, I recorded this podfic a full 24 hours ago, and immediately after recording it, I made some kind of verbally flaily reader's notes, and they were very enthusiastic. And then I woke up for work this morning, and I was still thinking about this story and how much it means to me, and I wrote some notes down so I could record some slightly more coherent reader's notes. So, we will see if this is actually any better, depending on which version I end up liking more, I guess. I just want to say, to start this off, I owe an incredible thank you to Countess of Biscuit. I was so incredibly spoiled for Star Wars Rare Pair Exchange this year. I got three things, and they all just hit me in the heart in ways that I wasn't expecting, and everything about all of the things that I got gave me so much joy. But this particular story, I had to keep safety tabbing away because it was too much good feeling all at once, and I couldn't process it. So I'd safety tab away and give it a minute for the joy to settle and simmer down a little, and then I'd come back and read like two paragraphs, and then I'd yell, "It's like it was written for me!" And my roommate would say something like, "Yes, because it was." And we did that for a couple times in a row. It took me like 3 days to get through this story originally because it was just too much good to process all at once. And it just found this perfect niche of all the things I wanted and didn't know I wanted and didn't know I wanted quite like that in a way that made me incredibly overjoyed. It just hit all of the buttons, and one of the very, very, very good for me buttons was the use of the Resonare in this story. The Resonare are the six actions for people who are not as well, I don't want to say well-versed, but people who don't spend quite as much time doing the deep dive of Mando culture as I have spent, and they were something that I asked for in all caps on my Repair Exchange letter. But the six actions are: a Mandalorian must wear armor, a Mandalorian must speak Mandoa, a Mandalorian must defend themselves and their family, a Mandalorian must contribute to the overall well-being of the clan, a Mandalorian must raise their children as Mandalorians, and a Mandalorian must heed the Mandalore's call and rally to their cause. And if you can tick off those six things, no matter what planet you're from, no matter what species you are, no matter where you were born or who you, like, that, if you follow these six rules, you can call yourself a Mandalorian in Mando culture of the extended universe, or, which is, you know what, that was the other thing I really loved about this, that it was, like, a really good blend of EU stuff that I loved and Legend stuff that I loved and a little bit of Disney stuff. And I'm mostly sort of, you know, choose your own canon when it comes to Star Wars. But if you follow the Resonare, if you meet these six tenets, you're a Mandalorian. If you don't, you're Darmanda, which is what Bo-Katan calls Boba before she really meets him. You are
not a Mandalorian, and you're ignorant of your heritage, and you're not able to become, like, the best version of yourself. And then throughout this story, okay, so there's a little rhyme too that goes with it, just so that I can have, like, my moment of Rezalnare feelings. Education and armor, self-defense, our tribe, our language and our leader all help us survive. And in Mando, or Mandoa, it goes like this. Bajrubal Beskargam, Aranov Alith, Mandoa Bal Mandalor, An Vinkunyam Mi. And that's the bit that Boba recites as he's going down on Bo-Katan, and it was so fucking good for me, which says something about me, I guess. We're not going to examine that too deeply. We will come back to that later. but I love the idea of Mandalore as a culture of adoption, and Mandalorian, like the Mandalorian Empire, kind of forcibly adopting some planets into their empire. But you know what? That's fine. The Romans did it too, and it worked out great for them. this idea of a culture of adoption, if you follow the rules, it's not even like they're hard rules. If you just abide by these tenets, you're a Mandalorian. Doesn't matter what your income is, doesn't matter what your political leanings are, it doesn't matter what your species is, it doesn't, you're adopting people into your rules, and it just, the guiding principles of the Rezalnare are my jam. And then Countess of Biscuit did something actually really incredible with the Rezalnare throughout this fic that I loved a lot, because like, that was sort of the capstone, your conclusion sentence was the bit where he goes down on her. But we start with, she gives him back his armor. She cleans it up. Education, the part where Bo is sort of quizzing Boba a little bit on what's your father's sigil like? What do you know about, like, our culture and our people as we stand now? Self-defense goes right back to she gave him, like, his ability to protect himself with the blaster that she gives him in the very, very interest. I don't know what that word means. The very, very beginning when he's still on bed rest. She also talks to Boba about how his dad raised him. Like, his dad didn't quite raise him as strictly Mandalorian as, like, Boba might have been. But Jango taught Boba, these are our stories, these are our myths, these are our heritage. So he's got that, and we go over it. And then there's that one line about Bo and Boba are going back and forth, and she's like, have you ever raised arms for anyone but yourself? And, like, that's kind of the last one where, that up to that point, Boba Fett has always been a bit his own, not anyone else's. And that's one of the things that the Rezalnare, you have to take into account, is if the Mandalore calls you, you do what they say. Anyway, so I just liked this idea of you sort of see Bo almost, I might be forcing it, it probably wasn't an intentional thing on the author's part, but you see Bo, like, going through the Rezalnare with Boba as he recuperates, and then you end with him, like, yes, I am reciting the rhyme, I am acknowledging this part of my heritage, I am maybe not swearing fealty to Bo-Katan, but a lot more loyalty maybe than he had to her. Which just so good for me. So good for me. The Rezalnare are my jam, and it's not really something that you see a lot in fic, and it's not something we've seen yet on The Mandalorian either, because
Like, okay, the reader's notes for this is not the place to get into my slightly conflicted feelings about The Mandalorian, because on the one hand, yay, and on the other hand, oh, you're making me a little grumpy. But I live in hope that that's something that we will see in our new version, because it's not, it's like Karen Travis era of Mando canon and not Clone Wars or new Disney canon. Anyway, Threzanare, it was so good for me. Kind of the biscuit. I owe you my heart. There were just so many moments in this story that got to me in a way that I wasn't expecting, and then they just stabbed me in the heart, and I don't know. Oh, the throwaway line about Bo-Katan. Thinking about wearing Boba's helmet while she masturbates. Says something about the Mandos. Says something about me. Hot damn. Moving on. I don't know if I'm going to leave that in there. But it was just a lot. That moment was really good for me. I really loved, when I was reading this, the very fluid switch between Basic and Mandoa. I loved it a little less when I was reading it aloud, because I don't know that all of my pronunciation is quite accurate, but anything that sounds wrong, we're going to call it regional dialect, because Bo grew up on Kalevala and not on Mandalore proper. And also because it's a fucking big empire and there's going to be regional accents all over the place. That's it. We're calling it regional accent and not, I don't remember what letters sound like. But I thought it was so great because it wasn't really just throwaway words. It was words that mean things. Like, literally, the title, Sukuigar, means hello, it's a greeting, but it literally means, so you're still alive. Which is the whole premise of this story. He's still alive. It made me so happy. And then there's like, what is it? Baslan Zhevla, which is a callback to something I wasn't expecting in this. The words on their own mean to leave quietly or a quiet departure. But it's also a callback to something from, like, Knights of the Old Republic, the Mandalorian Jedi, like, wars in the, like, 1,000 years before current canon, which was a period when the Mandalorian Empire was kind of at war with the Jedi, and there was a whole thing where some of the Jedi went into hiding, and they called that period Baslan Shevla, which is when they went into hiding to only come back stronger as the true Mandalorians, and also that was, like, one of the things that, like, kept them cohesive while they were in hiding and not actively being visibly Mandalorian was their practice of the Rezzonare. So it just felt really good to me to have this callback, but also to like acknowledge the sort of EU canon of it all, and also the life cycle of the Mandalorian. I have notes about the things I want to talk about, and I keep getting distracted. One of the things I really, really loved about this story was the scene where Bo calls some of the clones to come visit Boba. Because, A, these are some of, like, early days batch clones who would have grown up on Kamino with Boba and would have grown up under the tutelage of Jango Fett and, like, Cal Skarada and the first couple batches of clones grew up more, A, like people, and B, like Mandalorians, than the clones who came about after Jango sort of distanced himself from the project, and then especially after Jango died, when the Kaminoans were like, no, we don't want people, we want product. But the earliest, the oldest clones would have had a history with Boba, at least in as far as knowing who he was and knowing sort of a bit, like, they would have had an emotional connection to him. And one of the things I love to see explored is sort of Boba Fett's own reaction to the clones, because he doesn't really acknowledge them as these are my brothers the way, like, the clones who become soldiers call each other brother that we see, say, in Clone Wars, despite the fact that they are all biologically identical. And that's one of the things that I love to see explored, that that Boba Fett considers himself the son of Jango, but he does not consider the clones also the sons of Jango. And it's a real twisted up and sort of self-hurting, and also, like, what is your distinction about what makes someone family and what doesn't? And it's so good to see that, because the clones are, like, they're ready to embrace him and they're ready to give him shit for being the little brother. And he's like, I have been on my own for many years. I am not ready for family reunions like this. And it was just so good for me to see these different levels of it, especially when we start to bring in Fen Shisa. Fen Shisa, honorable mention. One of the things I love about that guy is how he basically has the identical helmet to Boba Fett, except he also has, like, J-Guys over his T-Visor, to the point where, like, people mix them up in canon. Fen Shisa was a Mandalorian who served some time with Jango Fett, or they ran into each other in... Fuck, I'm mixing up my canons. Basically, Fen Shisa thought that Jango Fett, who was the last Mandalore under the tradition of the true Mandalorians, which we'll get to that later in my Mando feelings, he had a very particular, very strong reputation as the last true Mandalore. And Shisa Fett thought that the thing that Mandalore needed was a Mandalore of the Fett line. So what does he do? He picks up Spar, who is a clone who ran away from home and doesn't want anything to do with the Grand Army of the Republic. And he's like, hey, nobody knows how many sons Fett had. Put on your acting shoes and we'll let you be Fett's junior. And he props up Spar as Mandalore the fuck, what is it? Time to Wikipedia. It starts with an R. Resurgence, Reviver, something. Anyway, so you got that one. And then something happens to Spar and he doesn't want to be the Mandalore anymore. So Fen Shisa finds Fi, who has a cameo here in this story. And that made me hearts. And he's like, hey, you're a Fett kid. What Mandalore needs is a Fett Mandalore. And Fi's like, I've just had, like, a traumatic brain injury. I'm not in the mood to be leading some planets. And then, and basically, Shisa spends a significant portion of his days being like, no, I don't want to be the Mandalore. I want a Fett to be the Mandalore. And then I just love the, like, slightly exaggerated, but also I love the idea that he's just hunting down every possible clone who's still alive. Like, do you want to be Mandalore? You're technically a Fett. Do you want to be Mandalore? And he really wants to build the Fett dynasty of Mandalore. Which I guess brings us to a recap of the political factions of Mandalore. Because that's what you signed up for when you downloaded this podfic. You have the true Mandalorians, who, that's what they call themselves, have a blend of empire building and warrior culture and adherence to the traditionalist ways, and they all kind of get wiped out by Death Watch, who are even more militaristic, expansionist, warrior code. The only people who are worth it are our people. A little bit xenophobic and a lot of bit go boom. And then you have the new Mandalorians, who are Satine Kryze's people, who are the only way Mandalore can prosper in this new version of the galaxy, where we don't really have the might of our multi-planetary empire, is to be pacifist and to show the rest of the Republic that we are worth considering. So you have, like, basically each one of these factions of Mandalorians. It's almost like you've got the Death Watch on the far end, and then you've got the true Mandalorians in the middle, and you have the new Mandalorians on the other end of the spectrum. And each one of them considers themselves the only real Mandalorians, and the other ones are fake. and so you have the true Mandalorians kind of carrying down the title of Mandalore, M-A-N-D-A, apostrophe, Mandalore, not like the head of the Empire, by way of great deeds, and you can challenge a person for the title, and if you win the fight, then you are the Mandalore, or it can be passed down in moments of, like, deathbed confession situation, which is how Jango Fett got the title, because the previous Mandalore gave it to Jango Fett when he was, like, fuck, I don't remember, 15, 16, during shenanigans that happened. And then you have Satine's people, the new Mandalorians, who are following the Royal House of Kryze, or the Ducal House of Kryze, whatever. But they're from Kalevala. They're not actually from Mandalore. So you have another noble family sort of calling claim on the throne. And then you have Death Watch, who are like, fuck this noise. We want to go back to the most extreme version of ourselves. And you have Pre Vizsla, who is claiming to be the ruler by right of I have the dark saber. And Bo-Katan in the Clone Wars, I just poked myself in my own eye from gesticulating. Oh my god, sides with the Death Watch because she thinks her sister Satine's pacifism is not going to stand up well in the face of everything in the long run. And because the new Mandalorians were all pretty much entirely wiped out at the Battle of Galadron, which was actually a trap set by the Death Watch folks to get the Jedi to massacre the true Mandalorians. Anyway, yeah, shit gets weird. Satine is pacifist and Bo-Katan is like, militaristic, let's do this. And so you have Bo-Katan in a weird position by way of she's got the Death Watch backing, and then her sister dies, and she kind of reconsiders her stance on things, and then so she ends up sort of more moderate towards the pacifist end of things, and she has her sister's legacy, so she is able to pull people there. And then in Rebels, spoiler for a thing that happens in Rebels, some of my favorite episodes, Sabine Wren gets her hands on the Darksaber and is like, actually, I'm only like 19 years old. I'm not ready to be a ruler of a multiplanetary anything, especially not in the face of the Empire when I'm still being a rebel and using my exploding face paint. So I'm going to pass this off to someone who can do more with it at this time. And Sabine gives the Darksaber to Bo. So Bo now has, basically, she's got clutch for 2 out of 3 types of Mandalorians, except for the fact that there's now the fucking Saxons on Mandalore proper and Sundari who are siding with the Empire. It's like there's political shenanigans out the wazoo. I love it. And there's not a lot of true Mandalorians left because most of them got wiped out and then sort of sided themselves with either the new or the Death Watch, depending on where their leanings towards Beskar Gemfell. And then you have Boba Fett, who is, legally speaking, the heir of Jango Fett, in that Jango Fett considers Boba his child and doesn't consider the clones his children. Which, again, something to think about. It's not winning all of the Father of the Year awards. But there is a legacy attached to the Fett name, and it's not just Shisa, who wants to see what this guy's gonna do with it. It's not just Shisa who's waiting to see which side of the line he falls down on. So, like, kind of, I'm really into this Bo-Katan, Boba power couple consolidating thing here, because together they bring a lot to the table as far as uniting the various clans and factions in a way that could overthrow the Empire. But then you've got Boba, who's been on his own for the last 20 years, and from what he's been doing, you kind of get the idea that he doesn't want to make, he doesn't want to claim his father's legacy. So the fact that he is willing to recite the Rez'al Nahr'i while going down on Bo-Katan means a lot. Anyway, I'm just super here for the political shenanigans of it, and I think it's interesting to see, we're not going to talk about the last 30 seconds of The Mandalorian, because I don't like any of those implications. Bo-Katan has the Darksaber, and she fucking rolls with it. That's what's happening. No fucking moths. Anyway, I have seen your canon and substituted it with my own. But I really love all these, like, political eddies and machinations going on in the background of all of it. And in the foreground, it's like, no, I'm going to be a decent person and give this guy medical care because he's partially digested. But if it happens to consolidate my power in a way that brings safety and security to my people, Bo-Katan's gonna roll with it. And if he happens to be hot, too, and he's pitching a very healthy tent, then that's even better. who is Fen Shisa? I feel like we covered that. Political ramifications of Boba and Bo-Katan. Melding different Mando backstories. Bo and the Darksaber and Sabine. One of the things I really loved about the story. One of the things, there's so many things. So there's that one line about how Bo has picked her heir and she plans on passing the Darksaber down peacefully. Because where the title of Mandalore passed by the true Mandalorians usually involves either somebody dying by battle or like somebody losing by battle, the passage of the Darksaber almost always, with the exception of when Sabine Wren steps in, ends with the previous owner dying. It's like the Elder Wand of outer space. And the fact that Bo wants to make this a first in the history of the Darksaber, she wants to make it a peaceful transition where she's willingly giving this over to a person that she thinks could lead their people in a, you know, new direction for the future. I think that's incredible, and it makes me so happy. And I'm absolutely going to drop $30 for a plastic laser sword when it comes out next spring. it's going to make different noises when you hit people with it. I'm so excited. Another thing that I thought was genius was, usually I have a very strong aversion to the word fuck in Star Wars, because we have sort of the canon approved swear words. But I love what Countess of Biscuit did, where fuck is what adults say and criff is what children say. And then this idea of Boba Fett, who is a, he is a full-ass adult with his own jetpack. And he's basically doing the equivalent of saying peanut butter when he stubs his toe. And sort of what that says about this guy. I loved that. And then Bo sort of laughing at him about it made me full of joy. Just too good for words. The way that the world building of this managed to incorporate so many different aspects of the various canons that I love, and it's not that any one of these are peripheral characters. They are absolutely the main characters of the story, but they are not necessarily the characters who are main characters for other people's stories. I don't know. I just loved seeing the focus of everything going on in the Rebellion era as filtered through the lens of Bo-Katan's history, and it made me so happy inside. And then you get cameos from the Rebels, and you get cameos from Leia, because
That's the other thing, the bit about how Leia's going to put Shisa on a leash. When she was hunting the galaxy to find Boba Fett, to find Han in Carbonite, she had a run-in with Shisa, and basically she, like, pins him up against a tree and makes out with him until he gives her answers. It's beautiful. It's a wonderful moment. Leia likes boys in helmets. I'm here for it. Speaking of helmets, this was such a good moment for me because one of the things that's got me a little bit disgruntled with The Mandalorian is this whole Mandalorians can take their helmets off versus Din Djarin's I will never take my helmet off, that's not allowed. And the throwaway line that in there about, like, she's always curious about the diaspora. I keep saying diaspora. It's not, they're not spores. Although I kind of like that idea. They have a round head. They pop up out of nowhere. Like daisies. Anyway. That there's a line about how Boba has been forcibly naked in her presence. And she's hoping one day for him to voluntarily take his helmet off. Because it is an emotional connection. It's literally armor against the world. And by putting it back on, basically he's becoming himself again. And also the bit where she's like, I kind of want to masturbate while wearing his face. In a way that's a little bit less creepy than it sounds out loud because, you know, the Mandos are in their way. But, like, dude, it's like wearing his jacket or something, but better and more intimate and kind of hot, which says something about me. But also about Mandos as a whole. Plus, it gave me an excuse to use sound effects, which is always a fun time in a podfic. Also, oh my god. Okay, can we talk for a second about the fact that basically Baby Boba and Jango had the equivalent of Simba and Mufasa's conversation about the stars? The stars are the ancient kings of the past looking down on you, and that's what Kara is. It's the Mandalorian heroes of the past, the Mandalorian leaders of the past looking down on Mandalore. Baby Boba is Baby Simba, okay? I'm having a moment here. Yeah, I... And then, like, just sort of going back to Boba's history for a hot second, this story, it's got a genius moment that, oh, so fucking heartbreaking. The first war orphan counting out the last, because Boba's the first kid whose dad died for the war, and... And if you follow this to the extent of episode 6, Luke and Leia are the last orphans, right? With the, well, not, I guess not really, because the Empire is going to continue on being like splinter bits. But, like, I love that idea of these sort of encapsulating, like, the whole of the Clone Wars through the eyes of Boba. Especially, and circling back around, when contrasted with the Batch 1 clones, who were raised much more Mandalorianly than, like, later batches of clones, because the earlier batches were raised by Jango Fett, and something that got, like, they've adopted the farm, they've adopted the legacy, the clones who aren't automatically aging to death at the end of the war are carrying that on in the way that it's like, oh yes, we acknowledge her. And then Boba having weird mixed feelings about the clones being his brothers or not. I love it so much. It just, they're making lives for themselves and it makes me happy. And the bit where Bo starts asking Boba about his sigil, his father's crest, and then Boba, like, shuts that shit down, but also kinda admits he doesn't know much by not answering. No one ever talks about his sigil. It's on all the fucking merch. And it has fucking layers of meaning with the, you know, the seven and the drops and the slashes and the color work. And it's just like, kind of sadistic, poked it with a stick and I loved it. I love the part, the way that Boba doesn't take Bo-Katan at her word also, because, like, it would be foolish to take an enemy at their word. He respects her enough as an adversary that he has to second guess everything. And, like, she understands that that's respect, right? He's not gonna just blindly trust her. And I love that so much. Look,
She didn't look. She didn't have to. The dark shape in her peripheral answered her curiosity enough. Bo-Katan was peeking like someone in a gym locker room, and I was so here for it. And she's aware she's being ridiculous. And he's pitching a rather large tent. Look, first thing Boba Fett checks after he's been nearly dissolved is whether or not he still has his dick and balls. Boba has his priorities straight. Bo-Katan has them too. And I think it's funny because, you know, Jango Fett has technically literally millions of offspring, and yet Boba is the one that they're setting up to start a dynasty, and I think that's glorious. I just had a lot of emotion about this, and it was an incredible experience to read this and to read it aloud, even though there were a couple places where I was kind of swearing at people's, you know, descendants and mothers and cursing your lineage kind of Zabiscus, because there were a couple sentences that were just really hard to get through. Like, just the prose was beautiful, but hard to read in one breath. But anyway, I love it so much. Everything about this just stabbed me in the heart button, and it was so good for me. Thank you, Countess Zabiscus, for writing something so perfectly tailored to me, and I think my reader's notes might actually be longer than the pod deck. Anyway, thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. Have a nice day.